I'm Allison Keyes. This is Tell Me More from NPR News. Michelle Martin is away. Rhode Island's education chief once called Central Falls High School one of the worst in the state. Fewer than half of the students graduate in 4 years. The Central Falls district fired almost 90 teachers and counselors earlier this year when the district and teachers union couldn't agree on reforms. President Obama and Education Secretary Arne Duncan both voiced support for the district's actions at the time. But after months of dramatic negotiations, the Central Falls district agreed to bring back the staff. Here's Jane Sessoms, president of the Rhode Island Teachers Union.
I am so proud of our teachers at Central Falls High School. They should be commended for their professionalism during this very difficult, turbulent months. They have always put the students first. I hope the rest of the country can learn from our experience and avoid the pitfalls of mass terminations.
Joining me now with an update on the situation is education reporter Elizabeth Harrison, who covers the story for WRNI, the NPR member station in Rhode Island. Elizabeth, welcome back.
It's nice to be here.
So how bad was it at the school, and how did it get that way in the first place?
Well, Central Falls High School has long been known as one of the worst in the state. It's a relatively poor area. It also has a lot of immigrant families, children who may be new to the country or who don't speak English at home. The district says that's about 30% of their population. So they have real challenges there.
What kind of reforms were the teachers protesting in the first place? Because this all broke down over a set of reforms that the district wanted to do to improve scores, right?
That's right. The reforms initially proposed by the district included lengthening the school day, adding time after school for tutoring and for faculty meetings, and time over the summer for training.
But there was a dispute over how that was all going to be paid for. Is that what broke everything apart?
Well, that's what it seems. It's hard to know because those negotiations happened behind closed doors. What we do know is that they couldn't reach an agreement. And that led to the district deciding they would fire all of the teachers and rehire no more than half of them under a turnaround plan that's described in state and federal policy.
Let's take a listen to a clip from Fran Gallo. She's the district superintendent there.
It's been extraordinarily fruitful because we gained an understanding of reform and of what it takes to make that reform. It's going to be hard. It's going to be difficult. This isn't like, oh boy, here's the cake, and now we're just going to sit down and enjoy eating it all. No, no. We may have all of the ingredients, but now it's how do we figure out how much of this and how much of that goes into making this very successful baking product that we're about to mix up.
But the thing is, the school still has a pretty long way to go. If only 7% of the students there are competent in math and fewer than half are graduating in 4 years, how is this new agreement going to help that? How does it specifically focus on improving test scores?
Well, that's the big question. And I think, you know, if we knew the answers to how to fix those problems, we wouldn't have schools like Central Falls High School. We wouldn't need policies like this that call for dramatic school turnarounds. I think what the district and what Superintendent Fran Gallo believes is that they now have a partnership with teachers that gives them the flexibility to try to address some of these issues. Whether their plan will be successful and what exactly their plan will mean is not clear yet. That's something they have to work out. But certainly it's going to include a 30-minute longer school day, more time, about an hour a week, that each teacher will devote after school to working, tutoring students. They've moved their faculty meetings to after the school day, so they will not be doing that during the school day, and they'll have more time in the day for instruction. Those are some of the things they're looking at. We'll see what else is part of the plan.
So what are parents saying about all this? I mean, if I have a kid at this school and scores are so bad there, where is the guarantee that something is going to change if they rehired all the teachers that were there in the first place?
Well, parents, at least up to this point, have been relatively quiet. The school doesn't have, you know, a parent-teacher organization that many schools have. You know, like a lot of high schools in neighborhoods like Central Falls, parents are busy, they're working, they're not as involved as the school would like. That's one of the complaints that teachers have. We do know that, you know, there were parents who advocated for the teachers and a lot of students who did as well, who felt that these teachers have been at the school a long time. They are personal friends with the students when they need them, you know, and sometimes they act as parental figures. So there are clearly some very close relationships that develop between the teachers and the students in this high school. That's one of the things they may have going for them as they move forward.
Is there some kind of backup plan? I mean, say you get a semester into this plan, whatever the final version ends up being, and there's no improvement in the scores. Do they have to go back to the drawing board? Are teachers' jobs at risk again, or do they just go on with the plan that they have?
Well, I think part of what the plan does is that it allows for a very in-depth evaluation process for teachers. And that may lead to some teachers being let go from the district if it turns out they're not able to do what supervisors feel they should be doing. The plan also calls for flexibility. That's one of the things the district really wanted, so that as they move forward, they can look at what they're doing, what changes they've made, and try to assess whether it's working, whether it's not working, and if it's not working, what to try instead.
Elizabeth Harrison is the education reporter for NPR member station WRNI in Rhode Island. She joins us today from their studios in Providence. Thanks, Elizabeth, for the update.
It's been a pleasure.
Congress, meanwhile, is working to finish up broad legislation to overhaul the way U.S. financial institutions are regulated. The Senate's bill would create a Consumer Financial Protection Agency. As NPR's Audie Cornish reports, that proposal faces strong opposition from, among others, auto dealers.
The proposed Consumer Protection Bureau in the Senate bill is supposed to police the financial industry for abuses in mortgages, credit cards, and other kinds of consumer debt, including car loans. But Ed Tonkin of the National Automobile Dealers Association says cars are their main business, and when it comes to loans, they're just intermediaries, so they shouldn't be included.
Auto dealers themselves only arrange the financing. They don't make the credit decision. They don't make the underwriting decision. They're able to go to the market, whether it's a captive finance company or a bank or a credit union, and find a competitive loan for the consumer.
David Arkish of the consumer group Public Citizen disagrees.
They're heavily involved in the financing of autos. A lot of them make more money on the financing than they make on the sale of the cars. And after home purchases, car purchases are the largest consumer purchases nationwide.
Consumer advocates and the White House are up in arms over an amendment by Kansas Republican Sam Brownback that would exempt the dealers from scrutiny by the proposed agency.
And at a time when we're trying to save our car companies, to make it more difficult for them to arrange financing for their customers makes no sense at all.
The amendment has made unlikely opponents of car dealers and the military because high-ranking defense officials say service members have been targets of predatory lending. That's left moderate Senate Democrats like Carl Levin of Michigan on the fence.
I just think there's a distinction between auto dealers and the other financial institutions, but I'm not sure whether or not there's a way that it can be opened up without creating other problems, so I just haven't decided what to do.
Last fall, car dealers got their exemption in the House version of the bill, and hundreds of them are flying in today to lobby the Senate. Audie Cornish, NPR News, the Capitol.
From NPR News, this is All Things Considered. I'm Michelle Norris.
And I'm Robert Siegel. The nation's preeminent scientific organization said today that the Earth is definitely warming and that scientists need to figure out how to predict and limit the effects of climate change. And it didn't stop there. It also called on the government to organize a massive and sustained effort to slow global warming. NPR's Christopher Joyce reports on the two-year research effort behind today's announcement.
The National Research Council is where Congress and the government go to get answers to tricky scientific questions. It's part of the National Academy of Sciences and essentially deputizes science's top guns to tackle those questions. Today, though, it was Robert Fry, an MBA and energy analyst at the economic think tank Resources for the Future, who summed up the NRC panel's view on climate change.
A principal conclusion of our report is that the country needs both a prompt and a sustained national commitment to reducing greenhouse gas emissions.
That's mostly carbon dioxide, mainly from burning fossil fuels like coal, oil, and natural gas. Although the report leaves the decision-making to politicians, it does get more prescriptive than previous Academy climate studies. For example, it states that the annual emissions from American factories, power plants, cars, agriculture, and the like, it's about 7 billion tons of greenhouse gases, must be cut at least a third. The report says total emissions over the next 40 years should not exceed 200 billion tons.
How hard is it to do the job? Well, it turns out meeting that emissions budget is a very challenging task.
One says, Fry, that will require a price on carbon emissions as well as inventing technologies that don't even exist yet. What does exist now is scientific evidence of warming. But earth scientist Pam Mattson from Stanford University, who led the report section on the state of the science, says measuring what's happening now isn't enough anymore.
The scientific community would say this is a core fact, basically, that climate is changing. We also have a lot more lines of evidence now indicating that humans are in large part the reason that increase in temperature is occurring. What we haven't done as much of is focus our attention on what to do about that.
The report says scientists need to spend more time figuring out what's going to change. For example, how will higher temperatures affect agriculture, and where and when? Mattson says that's a moving target, and it's largely guided by how much fossil energy people will be using.
There are a lot of uncertainties about the future, and the uncertainties are in large part because we don't know what people are going to do.
And what people do, Mattson adds, may depend on how well scientists explain what they know.
We miscommunicate all the time. For example, we use the term uncertainty all the time in science. It represents a quantitative statement of how well we know something. But think of what uncertainty means for most people. It means we don't know.
The point of this report, she and its author say, is to show that scientists do know that something must be done to keep the Earth's climate from heading into uncharted territory. Christopher Joyce, NPR News.
From NPR News, this is All Things Considered. I'm Robert Siegel.
And I'm Michelle Norris. Philip Levin is a marine biologist who knows how to think out of the box, or in this case, inside the frying pan. Levin works at the Northwest Fisheries Science Center in Seattle, and he was curious about the local decline of rockfish. But there wasn't much historical data about the rockfish population. Levin is a home cook and a foodie, and he and a colleague decided to do some research using old cookbooks. And while they didn't turn up much on the rockfish, they did learn a lot about the consumption of seafood in the Pacific Northwest. And Philip Levin joins me now to talk about what he learned. Welcome to the program.
Thanks very much for having me.
How many cookbooks did you actually scour, and how far back in time did you go?
We ended up looking at about 102, I think, cookbooks, a little over 3,000 recipes, and we went back into the late 1800s.
Where did you find these cookbooks? Where were they, at the library? Where are they kept?
Yeah, we went to basically every library in the Pacific Northwest, so mostly in Seattle, Portland, Bellingham, the major cities. My favorite cookbook is from the Ladies Aid Society of the First Seattle Christian Church, and that was in 1906, and that was typical of cookbooks of that time. But as you get into more recent years, it's more like, you know, the Pike's Place Market cookbook and that sort of thing.
Well, tell me about the Ladies Aid cookbook.
Well, my favorite recipe, and one that I actually made the other day, was called a substantial oyster dish. Basically, what you do is you cook rice in oyster juice, and then you add butter, and then egg yolks, and then butter, crackers, butter, cream, and tomato juice.
No more butter?
That's it, yeah. So I fed it to my wife, and the thing they didn't say in there was, be sure and keep the pathway from the table to the sink clear, because it was gross.
Oh, really?
But my chickens liked it.
You fed it to the chickens afterward.
Well, nobody else would eat it.
So after basically cataloging all these recipes, it sounds like you found no recipes for rockfish before 1970.
Yeah, almost no. There were one or two scattered about. But then in the mid-70s, they started appearing. And really, by the late 1980s, they were common. And then they start disappearing again in more recent years. And what happened was that in the 1970s, salmon fishing opportunities were declining. Nobody had really concentrated on rockfish up until that time. and then they became a target for fisheries as a way to make money, basically, for people who lost their opportunities with salmon fishing.
Mr. Levin, what do you do with all this information now?
That is a really good question. I think what we've found is the importance of using these historical type non-traditional research methods to do two things. One, it really shows how changes in the market conditions reflect what's going on in the water. And the other thing it does, which is it was really interesting to me, is I was a waiter in a seafood restaurant in the 1980s. And back then, the thing to do was blackened redfish. So you would just take redfish, which otherwise was pretty bland, and you'd coat it with butter and pepper and set it on fire, and everybody loved it. And a few years later, redfish were gone. Not completely gone, but overfished. And so it shows the power of, in that case, a single chef, Paul Prudhomme, to affect people's tastes and therefore exert fishing pressure and then result in the decline of a fish stock.
Philip Levin, it's been a pleasure to talk to you. I just am compelled to ask one last question. What's on your dinner table tonight?
I have no idea. hopefully not leftover substantial oyster dish.
We have lots of other cookbooks to consult. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Philip Levin is a National Marine Fisheries biologist. He's based in Seattle, Washington.
There were an estimated 400,000 concussions in high school sports during the 2008-2009 school year. And while there's a lot of talk about helping student athletes recover and get back into the game, there's been little focus on the student half of that equation. A head injury expert calls the effect of concussions on academic performance the untold story. And tomorrow, that will change. NPR's Tom Goldman reports.
Tellingly, it's the House Committee on Education and Labor that holds a Capitol Hill hearing Thursday about sports concussions and high school athletes. On the witness list, 19-year-old Michelle Pelton.
Michelle Belton Pelton.
That was the nickname she had as the hard-hitting catcher on her softball team in Swansea, Massachusetts. She was just as tough playing point guard on the basketball court.
I did not care if I got banged around. I didn't care if I banged anybody else around. And I was very aggressive, and I was good at what I did.
But then two basketball-related concussions at the age of 14 left Michelle Pelton in a daze. She was an eighth grader suffering pounding headaches and crushing fatigue, and who went to school, she says, and did nothing.
I learned something in school, and I'd go home and try to do my homework, and I couldn't remember it. Come test time, I'd look at it, and it's like the first time I've ever looked at it before in my life.
Pelton says her eighth grade teachers interpreted her lack of focus and concentration as laziness. In Pelton's words, they thought she was trying to beat the system.
They weren't educated about concussions neither, and I had post-concussion syndrome, which is, you know, all the symptoms of having a concussion, and sorry, I lost my train of thought.
Is that one of the results of what's happened to you?
Oh, yeah, that's still very ongoing. I just don't pay attention.
Things got better in high school. A long layoff from sports allowed her brain to recover. Pelton's grades improved, but during her high school years, Pelton would suffer five more concussions. By the end of her senior year, before she graduated, she was being tutored at home in her pajamas because she couldn't get up and go to school.
There hasn't been a lot of research on the academic consequences or the academic outcomes with sport-related concussion.
Much of the research that has been done has been by pediatric neuropsychologist Jerry Gioia. He runs the Washington, D.C. Area SCORE program, an acronym for Safe Concussion Outcome Recovery and Education. Dr. Gioia led a recent study to understand the impact of kids' head injuries on learning. He found about half of those he studied still had problems more than a month into their recovery.
You're talking about a month and a half of disruption of, you know, thinking, of memory, of concentration, of symptoms worsening every time you kind of put your head into things.
That's a significant chunk of time, says Joya, when grades and performance can suffer. He says a key to helping the growing number of student-athletes trying to cope with concussion is having informed school nurses, teachers, administrators who understand how to manage the problem, how to be patient, and give the student time to, as Joya puts it, let their brain software reset. After Michelle Pelt testifies tomorrow, she'll focus on her goal of becoming an emergency medical technician. She passed an EMT course and is scheduled to take a state exam next month. Pelton says motivation and intense focus and repetition helped her learn the material, and she has a message for people who may need her services in the future. I'd know what to do, she says. I could definitely save you. Tom Goldman, NPR News.
You're listening to NPR. All this week, we'll be hearing stories about one of America's most troubled cities, Detroit, and now a broader look. Michigan has the worst unemployment in the country, so it's using a program called No Worker Left Behind to retrain and reinvent its workforce. So far, more than 120,000 people have signed up, but many workers with certificates of completion are still looking for jobs. NPR's Tamara Keith reports.
For Karen Alexander, the last 18 months have been full of anxiety and frustration. She's missed mortgage payments, had to get food aid, and even had her utilities shut off for a few very cold days. It all started when she was laid off from her job at an auto supplier, where she'd worked for 32 years.
And it just kept going downhill, 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 until January of this year, when I actually got the approval for school. And then, you know, the sun started to shine again.
The 52-year-old single mom just completed training to become a certified nursing assistant.
I'm an example. I don't care what age you are. You know, I've got it in me still. I'm going to go for it.
Alexander is looking for work now at hospitals and nursing facilities near her home in Warren, Michigan. These jobs are entry-level positions that pay less than half of what she made in the auto industry. And as she scans through a job search website, the results are underwhelming.
You know, you can't give up. If you give up, then, you know, there was no sense in going through all this. I'm doing this for a reason. I set a goal that by the end of June, I would have a job.
One man who certainly has to hope she's right is Andy Levin, Michigan's chief workforce officer. He says the No Worker Left Behind program emphasizes longer-term training in fields deemed in demand.
If you're willing to become any number of jobs in advanced manufacturing, healthcare, renewable energy production, you know, on and on, we will give you up to $10,000 worth of free training at any Michigan community college, university, or other approved training program.
But figuring out which fields truly are in demand has proven an inexact science.
It's a roll of the dice, but, you know, it's the best roll that you have right now.
John Bierbussi is the executive director of Macomb St. Clair Michigan Works in suburban Detroit.
We do get information on what they expect to happen, and we try to align our training to those speculations. But it's speculation.
Even sure things sometimes aren't. Last year, an engineering staffing firm called Talisand saw that there was demand for workers in the piping design field. So the company teamed up with the county and the local community college to create a targeted program. The plan? Train out-of-work automotive designers for jobs mostly in the oil and gas industry. 49 people finished training before Bierbussi says it became clear the jobs hadn't materialized.
The credit crunch kind of caught up with them, too. Some of their expansions and things like that were put on hold because these companies could not get loans.
Gino Tadellini was one of the 49. He thought he'd found the perfect new career when he signed up for the pipeline design program.
Sounded really good to me, and with the new industry, and thought I'd give it a try.
Tadellini was so excited about it, he even recruited some of his former colleagues.
I thought it would be a good move. A year later, no such leads as far as employment, no formal interviews since then.
So far, just 9 of his classmates have gotten jobs in piping design. Several others are back in the auto industry. The rest, more than half, like Gino, are still looking. A state report estimates that only about 40% of laid-off workers who went through No Worker Left Behind training found jobs related to their field of study.
I think our numbers on that are great.
The state's Andy Levin says it's all about context. He points out this is the worst job market in generations.
There definitely are people who go and train to be something very specific and then they are not able to get a job, you know, in that way. But I think in general, a lot of people are sort of moving into whole new careers through this.
He stands by the idea that someone who has gotten training will ultimately be better off. Others involved in worker retraining say they are careful not to overpromise. Jim Jacobs is president of Macomb College, a large community college in the Detroit suburbs.
I mean, there's no illusions that somehow this program will uncover this hidden stream of jobs that exist somewhere in Michigan that no one has ever found before.
John Warner stands out in the Macomb College library. At 60 years old, he has a lot more gray hair than most of the other students. He's in the middle of a 2-year program in information technology.
I'm hoping for the best with getting through school and the economy picking up some and being able to find another job to get into that'll pay a fairly decent salary.
Warner needs this to work out.
It's kind of a tough thing, I think, to figure out here in Michigan exactly what's going to fly and what isn't.
He can only hope that the in-demand field he's training for will be in demand when he's done with school. Tamara Keith, NPR News.
You're listening to All Things Considered from NPR News.